So how are we doing? Is that everybody, are the words distinct enough to where you can hear more volume? How about now? Good? Okay, that means good? Okay. Whoa. So I'm going to begin this morning with a poem, a recent poem of mine called Night. In some ways, one goes forward in life after having been behind. One strives to get ahead, to get along or longer, and thus advances sideways by wise degrees toward an eventual dark stain whose triangulated nature is marked by its rugged appearance as if there were continuity in invisible image, not a matter of crawling or trolling, nor do steps or tropes or grips or gripes describe the dwindling moment. I speak of night on a revolving earth, impossible to describe, which we have conceived during the day, that cannot be traversed with steps taken to or from the refrigerator, generally found in the kitchen. But why? All things constantly reformatted that could be otherwise and elsewhere. Flesh, which is passed out twitching at the sad beginning of this epistolary tale. So yesterday I was mentioning the Jewish meditation retreat that I came home from New York for. And in that retreat, Danny Matt was talking about something or other in one of the texts. And he mentioned in passing a famous essay by Freud called The Antithetical Meaning of Primary Words. I never heard of that essay, but I looked it up, and you could find it. So I read it, and it was rather amazing to me, actually, as a person who has spoken and written in the English language exclusively for many, many decades. Doing this for so long, it has not been lost on me how slippery and weird words actually are, and how they do not necessarily indicate what they seem to be saying. That's mostly the subject of my poetry, how weird it is that words do not say what they seem to be saying. And just as Freud writes, in fact, sometimes words say the opposite of what they seem to mean, which is why we should always be suspicious of everything we think and say and write, because our actual meanings, if there are any, can be elusive. So this essay of Freud's begins with him saying that he's always been puzzled by the fact that in dreams, things often stand for the opposite of what they seem to stand for. And he could never understand why this was so until he ran across this essay by the German philologist Karl Abel, an essay published in 1884, which Freud many times referred to in his writings. And in this essay, Abel shows how in the very earliest languages, and he cites mostly ancient Egyptian language, there are a fair number of words that have two meanings, one of which is the opposite of the other. So Abel says, there could be a word, for instance, that would mean both weak and strong. The same word would mean both weak and strong. Or the same word might mean both light and dark. In addition to this strange phenomenon, he found there are many other words that are compound words that unite opposites into one word. Like there might be a word young-old, or far-near would be a word. Somehow, Abel says, and Freud notes, it somehow made sense in the development, a very, very early development of language, that words would contain their opposite meanings. And Freud was delighted to discover this, I say, because for him it explained why in dreams, in which we revert to ancient and less civilized, you know, parts of our psyche, we might often be coursing in opposites. And that's why dreams are so slippery and so hard to interpret with any confidence. The Diamond Sutra is famous for saying at the very end, this life is actually like a dream, you know, a bubble, a phantom, a flash of lightning. Many Buddhist texts say this, including the Lojong teachings. This life is a dream. So this that Freud is thinking about is just as true for our dream that we're dreaming right now as it is for the dream that we dreamed last night. Anyway, you may wonder, how is it possible that this could be, you know, that a word could have opposite meanings? How would they ever communicate with each other if they didn't know whether they meant strong or weak or light or dark when they said a word? And why did this happen? And why would this be a way that a language would develop? So in the essay, Freud quotes Abel at length, who explains how this happens. And I will quote you directly from the essay. However, and this is Freud talking, but most of the paragraph is quotations that he pulled from the Abel essay. However, the riddle is easier to solve than it appears to be. Our concepts owe their existence to comparisons. If it were always light, we should not be able to distinguish light from dark. And consequently, we should not be able to have either the concept of light or the word for it. It is clear that everything on this planet is relative and has an independent existence only insofar as it is differentiated in respect of its relations to other things. Since every concept is in this way the twin of its contrary, how could it be first thought of, and how could it be communicated to other people who were trying to conceive it, other than by being measured against its contrary? Since the concept of strength could not be formed except as contrary to weakness, the word denoting strong contained a simultaneous recollection of weak as the thing by means of which it first came into existence. In reality, the word denoted neither strong nor weak, but the relation and difference between the two which created both of them equally. Human beings were not, in fact, able to acquire this oldest and simplest concept, these oldest and simplest concepts, except as contraries to their contraries, and only learned by degrees to separate the two sides of an antithesis and think of one without conscious comparison with the other. Isn't that fascinating? I thought that was so interesting. So this, I think if you think about it, it's telling you that our thinking and talking, which on the surface of it seems to be so clear, because we're always separating one thing for clarity, one word from another word, that this clear thinking we have is actually rooted in an ancient sense of wholeness and unity that includes opposites. And we've forgotten this ancient wholeness, this ancient sense that was commonplace at one time of everything being only existing in relation to everything else. And we've forgotten it, I think, on purpose, because it is difficult to change and improve things unless you first critique them. If you're too aware of the unity and the relationship underlying things, it's difficult to make things simple enough and clear enough to be critical of them. And without critique, there can be no progress. And we have been devoted to improving and critiquing things for many, many generations now, which is a good thing, because we've made a much better world. But when the differentiation of language and thought goes too far, we get a kind of Tower of Babel effect. And critique becomes a monster. And we can notice this now, right? We're living in a world of like ultra critique. Perhaps we've gone too far with our ability to notice something and say, this is what it is, it could be better. It's creating a lot of trouble for us. Especially when the critique gets internalized and turned against ourselves, and turned against our innate capacity and desire for love and wholeness. And when we have lost that altogether, we can get very sick inside, which is maybe what's happening to a lot of us. I am me and not you. You are you, you're not me. That is not as good as the that I could imagine. This is how we live, and this is really mostly a game of words. Maybe we have taken this game too seriously for too long. Anyway, all of that is my brief introduction to case two of the Blue Cliff Record, which is my subject for this morning. Here's the story. You still able to hear okay? Can you tell one word from the other? Maybe.
Sometimes a little hard over here.
Yeah, right, it's odd. It's in different parts of the room, it's different, I know. Well, I will try to enunciate clearly, if possible. I don't forget. This is our story. Zhaozhou, teaching the assembly, said, "The ultimate path is without difficulty. Just avoid picking and choosing. As soon as there are words spoken, this is picking and choosing. This is clarity. This old monk does not abide within clarity, do you still preserve anything or not? And a certain monk came forward and asked, since you do not abide within clarity, what do you preserve? And Zhao Zhou replied, I don't know. And the monk said, since you don't know, teacher, why do you nevertheless say you do not abide within clarity? And Zhao Zhou said, it is enough to ask about the matter. Bow and withdraw. So that's the story of the encounter between Zhao Zhou and this a monk without a name. It's actually a pretty famous story. I'm sure you know it already. And I bring it up because it is a very, very important story for our life and practice. Zhao Zhou is our favorite Zen master. I guess we all know Zhao Zhou really well. We always bring him up. He studied with his teacher Nanchuan for 40 years. And together, in their early years together, they produced the little story that gives our Dharma family its name, Everyday Zen. Zhao Zhou once asked Nanchuan, what is the way? And Nanchuan said, everyday mind is the way. So Zhao Zhou studied with Nanchuan until Nanchuan passed away. At that time, Zhao Zhou was 60 years old and he went on pilgrimage to test his understanding. And he was on pilgrimage for 20 years, visiting various teachers, and at the age of 80, settled down to begin practicing Zen with whoever would show up. And he lived for 40 more years, or so they say, to the age of 120. Because he was so old, he didn't have anything to prove. Also, he didn't have enough energy to shout and beat people up like Zen masters are supposed to do. So he was famous for never doing any of that stuff, and instead using very simple and quiet words. And his teaching was so profound in that way that mostly people didn't even notice. You know, that's the great profound teacher. Nobody even notices him. He was as unspectacular as a sparrow. He is the Zen master who was once asked, does the dog have Buddha nature? And he said, no. Even though everybody knows that the dogs and all sentient beings have Buddha nature. Later, someone asked him, does the dog have Buddha nature? And he said, yes. But this koan, does the dog have Buddha nature? No, or mu, in Japanese, is the most famous of all Zen koans, and it is usually the first barrier koan in the classical Japanese systems of koan study. Anyway, that's Zhao Zhou. But in this story, he's actually quoting an old Zen poem from the third ancestor, from the poem Seal of Faith in the Heart, or Unbelieving in the Heart. It's different translations are given, but it's the Xunxin Ming. It's a really important Zen poem. And the opening lines of Xunxin Ming say, the ultimate path is without difficulty, just avoid picking and choosing. Just don't love or hate, and you will be lucid and clear. So I think that's pretty plain. We know what that means. Preference is very painful. I like this, I don't like that. But then, very often, I get the thing I don't like and don't get the thing I like, so it's painful. I like her, I don't like him, but now I'm stuck with him for decades. This is good, and that's bad, but I am in a bad situation and I can't get out of it. So preference is very painful. Preference is the opposite of gratitude. It's the opposite of unity and love. So, Sen-san is saying, we should get rid of it. So the Dharma is very simple. Just get rid of preference. Once we get rid of preference, we can be perfectly happy and peaceful. We can accept everything without preference, without loving and hating, which the poem is saying is bad, and they always go together. We'll be lucid and clear. Pretty simple. Of course, when you try to practice this, it takes about 24 hours before you realize it can't be done, right? It absolutely can't be done. You can't get out of bed in the morning without preference. You prefer to get up, so you get up. Or maybe not. Maybe you prefer to stay in bed, so you stay in bed. One way or the other, to get through the day, to be a living human being, you are going to have to exercise preference. You are going to love and hate. You can't help it. Because you prefer to live, not to die. You love life and you hate death, or at least you don't like it as much. I hope so, anyway. Of course, someone could prefer death, but that would also be a preference too. So, getting rid of preferences is impossible for a living being. So what in the world can our third Zen ancestor mean? So to save you the trouble, I'll tell you that the correct answer to this koan, so why should you struggle over this, you know? The correct answer to this koan is that you have to prefer and not prefer at the same time. So what do I mean by that? It means you have to prefer, you have to accept that you are a crazy human being with a conditioned life. You should enjoy your conditioning, you should celebrate it, but you should also have a drop of nothing, a drop of emptiness at the exact center of your preference. And that is what we are developing this week. A drop of nothing. A drop of emptiness. The capacity to allow what arises to arise and to let it go. You have to have a preference and to let go right in the middle of your preference. I would prefer to live. Oh, I have to die now. Okay, I can do that. Actually, what Zhaozhou was saying here is not the same as what Sen-san says. Zhaozhou is not talking about preference. He's talking about language and thought, which of course must precede preference. Before we can prefer something or not prefer it, we have to recognize it. We have to know what it is. We have to see it's this and not that. Otherwise, how could we prefer it? In Buddhism, and also I think in cognitive psychology, perception and language is more or less the same thing. There is no perception without the sign, without naming. So Zhaozhou is saying, as soon as there are words spoken, as soon as there is sensible thought and perception, this is already picking and choosing. And, he says, this is already clarity. I don't know if you can hear the difference here. He's putting preference, what he calls words being spoken, and non-preference, being beyond preference, which the third ancestor calls clarity, which the third ancestor says is the opposite of preference, right? Zhaozhou is putting both of these in the same basket. As soon as there are words spoken, there is picking and choosing, and there is clarity. Both. So Zhaozhou is collapsing Seng San's opposites into one word. Language and thought is not the enemy. Language and thought is not the bad guy. Language includes within it, Zhaozhou is teaching us both preferences, painfulness, and clarity, awakening. Our human communication, however full of misunderstanding and pain it may be, is also at the same time always true and beautiful. This week, we're enjoying silence, away from all the talk that Tim evoked for us in his opening remarks. The old saying goes, silence is golden, and it is. But speech, language are also golden. That is, golden when we remember what they really are, when we remember the nothing inside, the nothing that they are. Maybe if we're silent long enough, we can have a sense of this. Maybe it takes a certain amount of silence for us to recognize and see this point. Sometimes you may experience that your own thought rising up out of nowhere and passing away again into nowhere is just as beautiful as a heron flying by overhead and soon gone. But Zhaozhou doesn't stop there. He says, this old monk does not abide within clarity. Do you still preserve anything or not? So what is he saying? So let's be honest. We all have a preference for clarity and peacefulness over pain and confusion. Probably that's why we're here. When we're in pain, when we find ourselves confused, we're not happy campers. And we prefer enlightenment to delusion. We prefer light to darkness. But this is already painfulness and confusion, right? Remember what we read a few days ago? Bodhisattvas have no place to stand. They wander here and there freely, with no home. This freely wandering is their home. Their home everywhere. Exactly because they don't have a home to hold on to. So, Zhaozhou is saying here, and remember, he's talking. He's not shouting or throwing things. He's saying, yes, I'm human. I speak. Words are my heart, my mind, my experience. And I don't rest there. I don't rest anywhere. How about you? What are you holding on to? And a monk comes forward, and instead of responding to this, he turns the tables on Zhaozhou. What are you holding on to? He asks him. So you'd think Zhaozhou would say, nothing. But he doesn't say that. He says, I don't know. As you do know, I don't know is the ultimate Zen answer. It covers everything. It means you don't know. Maybe, what are you holding on to? I don't know. Maybe I'm holding on to a lot of things. Maybe I'm not holding on to anything. I don't know. But it also means all the things I'm holding on to, my family, my body, my health, my identity, my principles, my ethics. I don't know what any of these things actually are, or whether they are at all. I profoundly don't know. And I am facing this moment with resolve. Because in this moment, I don't know. Anything could be true. Anything could happen. So this is a very bold monk, you know, who is not at all intimidated by Zhaozhou. Maybe that's because he's a very clear, or she's a very clear-seeing monastic, or maybe it's because Zhaozhou is not too intimidating. But she presses the teacher still further, saying, since you don't know, teacher, why do you nevertheless say that you do not abide within clarity? Good point. If you really don't know, how can you be so sure of yourself? If Zen practice is the practice of I don't know, then aren't we going to be fuzzy and wishy-washy people, never taking a position, never holding fast to anything because we really don't know? Is this our practice? To be head-scratching, compliant, nice guys? Zhaozhou answered her, it's enough to ask about the matter, bow and withdraw. I'm sorry for you. You're never going to be right and not wrong. You're never going to be good and not bad. Your love is always going to include your hate. Your enlightenment is always going to include your delusion. Nevertheless, you are going to stand up in the middle of your life and speak and act as you are able, with resolve. This was I, a sparrow. I did my best. Farewell. That's you, every moment of your life. You face it, you live it with full resolve. And you bring up the question again and again and again and again. I don't know means you're always asking over and over and over again. There is always the question, as long as you live, the question never ends. It's an inexhaustible source of inspiration and liveliness. After which, you bow and withdraw. And the bow means, thank you very much for the opportunity of this moment to which I surrender. My Dharma name, Rinsho, means turning toward the light. The characters, Rin, means to meet or to face in the direction of, and Sho means to shine, to be brilliant or bright, or light, brightness. So for a long time I never had a particular translation of this name, and I didn't think anything about it. Who thinks about their name? Do you go around thinking about your name, like what does it mean, pondering your name? I think you had this name your entire life, and you probably never thought, like, what does my name mean? I never thought about it. But then, at the time of my Shiho ceremony, my teacher retranslated these characters as turning toward the light. And I thought that was pretty good. I like that. Because I do want to turn toward the light. And I keep trying, you know, to turn toward the light. But to me, turning toward the light doesn't mean turning away from the darkness. It means I'm always turning. We're always turning. Turning toward the light, yes, which means maybe right now I'm facing the darkness, and now I'm going to turn toward the light. Or maybe it's the opposite. In turning toward the light, I am also inevitably turning toward the darkness. Because how could there be darkness without light? How could there be light without dark? How could there be night without day? Just like in Freud's essay, Abel's essay, it should be one word, night, day, light, dark. One of our dear Sangha members at home is an actor, and she was one of the founding members of the Traveling Jewish Theater, and they always had great productions. And I'll never forget, she did a solo piece many years ago in which she plays an old crotchety Jewish lady, which in fact she is anyway. And she played this character. And this character, you know, kind of bent over and going around, complaining about everything, yakking on and on and on and on and on. And there's one bit in the performance where she talks about, she's always falling down and getting up. You know, old people often fall down. She's always falling down and getting up. She says, falling down, getting up, falling down, getting up. It's one word. She says, fall down, get up. It's one word, fall down, get up. Right. So, dear Dharma brothers and sisters, whatever happens, whether it's a moment of facing the light, our face shining in the light, or facing the darkness, let us continue to fall down, get up together, as we have been doing for a long time now. Let's continue. And to those of you hitting the road today and heading out into other activities, thank you very much for being here. Enjoy the freedom, no zazen, no bells. You can talk anytime you want. You can eat and drink whatever you feel like it, according to your choice and preference. What a horrible thing. Enjoy it, though. Enjoy it. And for those of you, maybe some of you are just coming, I know some will be coming. Welcome to our session. And as always, there's only one thing to do. Right straight ahead. Let's continue. Thank you all very much.